This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 16th of March, 2015, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up on today's programme, he may have scored political points in the US Congress, but things aren't looking as good for Benjamin Netanyahu on the home front. With tomorrow's big election looming, polls suggest his time as PM may be coming to an end. Then, Tony Blair has announced he's stepping down as Middle East envoy after 8 years. We'll try to resist the jokes about the excellent progress he's made. And later in the show, the geopolitical version of Where's Wally has come to an end. The lesser-spotted Putin has been found. We'll ask what his disappearance says about the state of Russia. I'll discuss those stories and maybe a couple more with Tim Marshall and Nina Schick right here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Nina Schick from the think tank Open Europe and Tim Marshall, formerly diplomatic editor at Sky News, now the founder of thewhatandthewhy.com. And I think we need to start with the big news of the day. Vladimir Putin is not dead. He has not been overthrown in a palace coup, disappointing conspiracy theorists and neocons worldwide. He appeared today in St. Petersburg next to Almazbek Atambayev, who, of course, we all know is the president of Kyrgyzstan. So, Tim Marshall, where has he been for the last 11 days? And why does this matter? Because it sort of does, doesn't it?
It's both a joke and deadly serious simultaneously. I mean, it's alive! It's wonderful news, because if he wasn't, that would be pretty serious. The joke is that, you know, oh, he went off to have a baby in Switzerland. There's all these different rumours, and that's why it is a bit funny. But there's got to be a serious side of it, because the leader of Russia does not disappear for 10 days unless there's something behind it. Now, it could be as benign as him having a very severe flu, because Mr. Muscle Man doesn't get flu. The man with his finger on the button doesn't get flu. The man who wrestles bears semi-naked does not get flu. And it would be a blow to him to be sort of say that he had. And that's the best scenario you can come up with. There are others, though, which are somewhat darker, which is that there was something going on behind the scenes. There was a serious illness. You know, there's certainly something, and there's no way it's just that he fancied not being on the TV for 10 days.
No, he's not the sort of man that perhaps doesn't fancy being on TV for 10 days. Nina Schick, it also just highlights how much power in Russia is invested in one single man.
Oh, absolutely. And throughout, you know, the Ukraine crisis over the past year, we've seen that. And we've particularly seen that in the fact that once the EU and the West has put these economic sanctions on Russia and it's been hurting Russia a lot, that has not altered the course of Vladimir Putin. So economic considerations are not his primary motivation. And despite the fact that, you know, the Russian economy is, as I said, suffering greatly, those particularly boisterous brand of nationalism, which we're seeing coming from Putin, does not seem to be tampered. Today, they started, you know, great military exercises. And on the anniversary of the Crimean annexation, Putin actually revealed in a state documentary this morning that they were about to, you know, mobilize their nuclear weaponry. So it's very scary that one man can hold so much power.
We'll come on to some of those other things concerning Russia in a moment, Tim. But first, you know, it's not just Vladimir Putin who as a leader needs to have this aura of invincibility. We expect this now of all our leaders, and we're going to mention Tony Blair in a moment, but when Tony Blair went into hospital with a heart complaint, you know, Downing Street was incredibly worried about that coming out. And we've seen that with US presidents as well, certainly in recent years.
Go all the way back to Carter. He went out jogging once. He looked an absolute wreck, had to be supported, and it damaged an already damaged presidency. It does matter, but I think it matters more somewhere like Russia, where there's much more power centralized around one figure, and then if he falls, there is a vacuum, and you don't know what goes into that vacuum. Whereas in a more stable democracy, such as the United Kingdom, unfortunately, the Prime Minister falls under a number 10 bus going down Whitehall, the system will kick in and the stability would still be there. I'm not sure how stable the internal machinations of Russia would be if Mr. Putin fell under a bus.
And of course, if we were to look at the example of Germany, Angela Merkel felt very comfortable admitting that she had you know, broken some bones after having a skiing accident, and you know, that had happened, and that's not a big deal, and life in Germany will go on as normal.
Oh, absolutely. And of course, as Tim rightly pointed out, I think, you know, the very different kind of power dynamics and political structures are really coming into play when we see that. And Putin, of course, is one of the world's leading machos, which is one of the reasons why Angela Merkel, particularly from a personal perspective, even though she knows she has to work with him and has to keep, you know, those avenues for diplomatic discussion with Russia open, doesn't personally like him.
One very, very brief thing that I did notice on today's footage, it was mute. I can't make up my mind why it was mute. You know, they were chatting away. Apparently he said, oh, you know, you've been having fun gossiping.
Life would be boring without gossip.
Well, life would be boring without gossip. How true. I just wonder, why wasn't there any sound on that video? But it's probably just, you know, a technical malfunction or something. And the guy looked all right, a little bit waxy, but he looked all right. So did his counterpart. And I think it has put an end to these rumours. And as we've talked about, he's a busy off saying to 45,000 troops, get yourselves up to the Arctic border.
Well, indeed. And we'll come on to that in just a moment. Neil, let's talk about, you know, the conflict in eastern Ukraine. Austria's foreign ministers today said that the Minsk agreement is the only tool we have. Minsk is the biggest chance for a peaceful solution, and that despite its laboriousness and delays, which is one way of putting it, there have been slight improvements. Is Austria and other nations that are involved in this trying to put a positive spin on this? Or, you know, is it fair to say, well, you know, there have been slight improvements?
Well, I think Minsk offers a glimmer of hope, but I certainly would think it's naive to think that, you know, this will be the be-all and end-all and it will resolve the conflict. I mean, if anything, what's been going on recently shows, you know, the ceasefire is very, very fragile, and Putin's actions don't convey, you know, that he is a man who actually wants to pull, you know, separatists out of Ukraine. So I think that's on one side, on the Russian side. But on the other side, from the EU itself, it's been very, very weak in its response to the Ukraine crisis. There certainly isn't one united EU strategy on how to deal with Russia. And this is why, you know, they're putting all their hope on the Minsk agreement, because amongst themselves, I mean, the EU member states can't agree whether or not to extend the sanctions on Russia. They'll be meeting later in Brussels this week to kind of decide whether or not those broader economic sanctions, which have already been put on Russia, should be extended. And some EU leaders, like Viktor Orban of Hungary, are openly flirting with Putin. So it's a very, very divided EU. And of course, Putin knows that, and he's using it to his own advantage.
And not just on the hard right in terms of Viktor Orban and Hungary, but with Syriza in Greece. Yeah. We've got an interview in the next issue of Monocle with the Deputy Defence Minister, who's, you know, very open about how he feels that it's important that that Greece has good relations with Russia. And, you know, are these sanctions actually helping? Maybe not. And it's actually hurting us. This is going to be a big thing for the EU to deal with.
I suspect what the Greeks are doing there is flirting with the Russians just so they can say to the Europeans, look, we could have other friends, you better give us a good deal. I mean, there is a whole backstory there about Greece and Turkey and the Mediterranean and the Navy and Russia getting out through the Bosphorus. I mean, all that's now circling around, and it never used to be until the recent crisis, both in Ukraine and in Greece. Russia's playing, I think, a dangerous but a very good game. And Minsk, as you said, it favours Russia. And the best thing they're going to do is freeze it. They're going to freeze the whole thing for several years and then come back and take another bite later on.
Nina, we've talked a lot over the last few years about Europe having a foreign policy and the difficulty of Europe having a foreign policy, because you've got now 28 different nation states that all, frankly, have their own views, some perhaps in the grand scheme of things more important than others. And yet this is the first real crisis where Europe's had to come together. In some ways, you know, despite everything, the fact that they have until now been united on a certain degree of sanctions, on actually being relatively strong, is it perhaps, or am I being perhaps too nice to them, to say that this is perhaps almost a success in terms of how the EU is dealing with this case?
I would certainly disagree with that. I think from my perspective, the fact that the EU does not have, you know, a common united foreign policy is probably one of its weaknesses.
But how can it?
Well, that's exactly, you know, inherent in the architecture of the EU. So these are bigger existential questions that the EU needs to ask itself. You have had some countries like traditionally the UK and France, which have led on EU foreign policy. But of course, Germany has really come to the fore during this Ukraine crisis. But that is inherent to the architecture of the EU, because on questions such as sanctions, you need unanimity on all 28 member states.
Well, on that, and I'll bring Tim, I'll bring you in on this in a moment, but on that, Nina, yes, for the EU to have sanctions, you need that. But what if 26 member states without Hungary and Greece were to decide there would still be sanctions?
It's not possible. You need unanimity amongst all 28 EU member states.
In a very complicated bilateral 26-way agreement.
Well, that would be reworking the fundamental architecture of how the EU would work. And so far, this is why we haven't been able to see a very strong response. It's so complicated because all the 28 member states have different relations to Russia. Some are economically motivated, others have historical reasons why, you know, that form their foreign policy towards Russia. So, for example, the Baltic states, they've been really hawkish on Russia, even though they know that economically they could suffer the most by having those relations with Russia break down. But of course, historical precedent is what guides their policy
towards. They also know that, you know, they're the ones that are going to be invaded or have little green men turn up inside their country. As you said, this documentary yesterday in Russia revealing, as if we didn't know already, that these little green men actually were Russian soldiers. Tim Marshall, we also mentioned as well today that, you know, tens of thousands of troops have begun war games across Russia, including the Navy's Northern Fleet, which has been called into full combat readiness, allegedly, in the Arctic North. Why do you think this could matter in the long term?
It's a process. It is one of a number of exercises, and every single time he triggers one, it ratchets up tension and it reminds people of the power that they have. This one is partially in response to the one that's happening in Norway. The Ukrainians have just had one. The Lithuanians are having a partial mobilization, and each side tries to outdo the other in growling, but without actually coming to blows. So I just think it's part of that. There is a wider story, and that is that Putin is absolutely determined that Russia will win the race for the Arctic, which is coming up over the next 10 years. And he's investing billions of rubles into building up the defence in the Arctic and the whole Northern Fleet. Going briefly back to your idea that the European Union had a success with these sanctions, absolutely not. They were all over the place. They were weak. And it was a really good example of how it is impossible to have a common foreign policy when it comes to the crunch. And I'm afraid the direction of travel is fragmentation. The only bright spot I can see on the horizon is that Donald Tusk has now taken, former Polish Prime Minister, has taken over. And I think he's got some brilliant ideas about how economically to take on Russia. And I think if Tusk's ideas could be accepted by most of the 28, they might get their act together.
On that point, Nina, do you think that Donald Tusk actually has the support or has the clout to build that support?
Well, he's a very respected, you know, European Council president. But again, his position is primarily defined by the fact that he used to be the Polish PM. So Poland has been one of the most hawkish states on Russia. But whether or not that's going to unite the rest of the EU, I would be highly skeptical.
Yeah. I mean, I just like his ideas. And I agree with
absolutely.
You.
Absolutely.
I mean, for example, he wants the EU to negotiate as one block for the gas prices. I mean, that really would concentrate minds in Moscow. I doubt he'll win that argument, but it's a pretty good idea.
No, absolutely. But I think one of the fundamental things that this entire, you know, judging from the perspective of somebody who analyzes the EU and what the EU does in the world, one of the most interesting things is, you know, that the EU had a very clouded neighborhood policy. And if their policy towards Ukraine in the beginning had been clearer, then perhaps this conflict in its entirety could have been avoided, because the thing that kicked it off was a trade war initially, whether or not Ukraine would become closer to the trade with the EU or Russia. And at that point, Russia had said, why can't the Ukraine trade with both the EU and Russia? And the EU leaders were pretty unanimous saying, no, you know, Ukraine has to come closer to the EU. And that was so silly, because anybody who studied Russian history for even 10 minutes knows that Russia will care much more what happens in Ukraine than the EU does.
Yeah.
And there is that problem, Tim Marsh, isn't there, that actually policymakers in Europe and certainly in America have real difficulty in even beginning to understand how Russia works.
Forgive me, I've mentioned this before, but it goes back to this paradise and power argument. Robert Kagan's quite influential book. He's a neocon, but you know, it doesn't mean his argument isn't correct. There's too many people who live in paradise, which is where we are, and Sweden and other places like that, and Germany and France, that's paradise. And we try to live by the rules of paradise. But there's too many people that do that that then try to take those rules outside into the world of power. And the moment you cross the Dnieper River, you're in the world of power. And the rules don't work. And they think if they do X, Y, and Z, Russia will also play ball. Russia will just keep coming at you because they live in the world of power. And there's not enough people over here who recognize it's really rough out there and you've got to stand up.
You say Russia lives in the world of power, but I think we can get overworked in thinking that Russia is still a major global power.
They're a major regional power.
They're a major regional power, yes. Regional power, yes. But, you know, their economy is screwed, yeah. Over-reliant on oil and gas and not much else. And their military, you know, it might look good in terms of numbers, but it's not necessarily, you know, actually strong.
They are spending more than, apart from the Americans, more than NATO. They are re-equipping everything that they've got. They're getting state-of-the-art stuff. They're piling money into it at a time when nearly all the NATO countries, including the United Kingdom, look to be cutting. They're on the upward trajectory. I mean, I don't want to come across as some anti-Russian person. I agree with Nina. When you look at the great sweep of history, you know the direction of travel that Russia will go in now. It is not contracting. It is expanding.
We'll leave it there just for now. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. My guests today, Tim Marshall and Nina Schick. When we return, Netanyahu's future and Tony Blair's past.
From her perch in Wan Chai, Aisha Spears is Monocle's Hong Kong bureau chief. Covering topics ranging from territorial disputes to urban upsets, the luxury goods sector to organic farming, Aisha Spears boasts one of the best beats at Monocle.
From the expanding political influence of Beijing to the growing economic power of Southeast Asia's middle class, we look at the people, businesses and nations that are shaping the exciting Asia-Pacific region.
From Sukhumvit to Orchard Road, Aisha Spears is Monocle's woman in Hong Kong and beyond. Catch her reports and check-ins around the clock right here on Monocle 24.
The Monocle Daily sets the agenda in Asia and considers what's been dominating the day in Europe and North America.
The programme is often co-hosted out of our Toronto and New York bureau and features regular interviews with special guests both there and across the Americas, as well as experts and analysts at our studios in London.
Monocle 24's regular weekly guide to the perfect Friday night in includes some of our favourite cities around the world and features the insights of the people who know those places best, our unrivalled network of correspondents.
Join me, Emma Nelson.
And me, Andrew Muller.
Your regular hosts for the Monocle Daily every weekday at 6 a.m. in Tokyo, 2200 hours in London.
And you're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me in the studio, Nina Schick and Tim Marshall. Let's turn now to Israel. Tomorrow the country goes to the polls. And Tim, it looks as if Benjamin Netanyahu may be possibly on his way out.
All comes down to the maths. Very complicated process they have in Israel. But, I mean, I can confidently predict the outcome of this election. It will be a coalition government.
Yes.
I mean, you heard it here first.
As a Knesset of a parliament of 120 seats, yeah. If Netanyahu wins, you know, he's only going to have 25 of those.
But this is what everyone's doing in Israel at the moment. They're all doing the maths. Let's say his Likud party gets 21 seats. He then has to go to the other two centre-right parties. Now he's got 46. Then he goes to Shas, the religious party. Now he's got 50. And then you build to 61 in your majority. At the moment, you can do the maths and see how he does that. Even though more popular than him, and he does appear to be going down in the polls, is Isaac Herzog from what is essentially the old Labour Party. And maybe he could well get 25 seats and be the biggest party. And then he tries to put together, OK, I need 10 from there, 5 from there. Those maths are actually harder to come by. I agree with you that Bibi's party, Likud, will probably be the second biggest party, not the biggest party. But when it comes to putting the coalition together, he has more clout. I mean, I don't know who's going to win it, but it's a very complicated mathematical equation of the horse trading that's going to be needed to be done.
He certainly, Nina, appears to be getting slightly rattled. In the last two or three days, he's had a rather strange rambling Facebook post, which I assumed strange rambling Facebook posts were the sort of things that you know we did when we were drunk. But no, apparently prime ministers do it as well, accusing it of being this worldwide conspiracy of international media and foreign leaders and NGOs and all sorts who apparently are out to get him. And now today he seems to have given up all attempts to aim for the centre by talking about, you know, there'll be no two-state solution, we're going to carry on building, we want to separate Bethlehem from Jerusalem. The rhetoric seems to be a lot stronger.
Well, certainly, and I think that partly he's also isolated himself. You know, he's had a very tricky relationship with his US allies, for example, and in the rest of the world, he's also come under fire, partly because he has been so staunch in some of his views, and I think that he kind of sees this as a conspiracy theory against him. But I think, like Tim, it's going to come down to the coalition building and the numbers, and I think that he's going to win, even though the opposition kind of Zionist Union is actually leading in the polls, and they'll probably have 21 to 24 seats. When it actually comes to building the coalition to get those 61 seats to have the majority, Netanyahu's party is going to find it much easier to find allies. That's what I think is going to happen.
The issue, Tim, will be is does he find all those allies on the right and we end up with, weirdly, an even more right-wing government than we've had recently? Or is there some form of grand coalition with the Zionist Union, which is a bit more centrist and perhaps, you know, Bibi's there for security and the Palestine issue and Iran, and Herzog and Livni can focus on, you know, the domestic issues.
I think it's quite possible. The National Unity Government, there was one going back to Peres and Sharon, where they actually shared the prime ministership. You can have the first 20 months, I'll have the second 20 months. I mean, it's odd, but it's their version of cohabitation.
Although, weirdly, that's actually what the Zionist Union had certainly appeared to agree on. Yeah. I mean, they talk about less now, but that was the original idea.
This is why it's a problem. But you see, I can't see Bibi accepting anything except being prime minister first and then seeing if he can work something out in the meantime. And this does matter. I don't think it matters for the Palestinian-Israeli situation, that I'm rather pessimistic about any forward motion on that. But it matters in the wider Middle East. If it is Itzhak Herzog as prime minister, I suspect the Iranians will test him very, very early on, probably on the northern border with Lebanon or possibly Syria. They will test a new inexperienced prime minister. If it's Netanyahu still in charge, then the potential of the clash and to make Israel more aggressive vis-a-vis Iran will still be there. So, you know, this is a very important election for the world, as well as for the Israelis and their economic issues, which is what it's being fought on. So it does matter, but I can see a coalition government, but it will be on Bibi's terms, I suspect.
Mm-hmm. And Nina, obviously, you know, it could have an impact in some way on the Iran nuclear talks, which, you know, let's not forget, which restart again today, and not between Iran and the US, but between Iran, the US, the EU, the permanent five plus one.
They're between Iran and the US.
No. It's like there's too much of a shorthand. It's between America and Iran. It's more than that. Okay.
We can argue later.
What I find interesting about the election campaign is that it seems to be fought, on is it going to be Bibi or anyone else except Bibi? You know, it's some of the major issues that are facing Israel, whether or not there will be a nuclear deal with Iran, rapprochement with Tehran, how the Arab states are falling apart either into the hands of jihadis, or all of these issues don't seem to have come up in this election. And I'd be interested to hear Tim's thoughts on this as well. You know, if there were a Zionist Union coalition, does that give any hope to the idea? Because traditionally, the center-left parties have been more prone to be able to agree to some kind of settlement with the Palestinians. Would that give any hope to those kind of peace talks restarting, or whether or not actually whatever happens, even though Bibi is most likely to, and I think, you know, that will continue and there will be no solution there.
I mean,
it's one that an answer that I don't know.
Tim, on that issue, I mean, it's yes, the centre-left have traditionally invested more in peace processes, and Tzipi Livni was very much involved in the and leading the most recent efforts, but they've also been very badly burnt by these over the last, you know, 2 decades, really. There is an issue over whether they'll be happy to go straight back into it.
Again, if it's Zionist Union, centre-left coalition, then the first thing he would do would go over to make friends with Obama. Mm. Mm. The second thing he'd do would be to probably try and get the Palestinian Authority back on track for at least cooperation, because, you know, there's been a whole thing about withholding the money, withholding cooperation has been going on recently. And I think they would try to course correct that, but the fundamentals wouldn't have changed. And so I don't see why there's suddenly going to be a two-state solution. It's a fascinating election. But you said that the left maybe do some of the deals. It was Sharon who left Gaza. Mm. And then they got the rockets, which is why the country has turned to the right, because they thought, well, what's the point of leaving anywhere? I think the right or the left can do the deal if they could just put the ducks in the line, the pieces together. Everybody knows the solution. Everybody knows the contours and the outline of the two states, which would happen. But it is putting Israeli politics in the place where it can happen. And there's no hope of that at the moment.
No, I mean, I was saying the left because it was Yitzhak Rabin with Oslo.
Yes.
It was, and obviously Barak tried as well, and Ehud Olmert before he left office. Since we talk about peace in the Middle East, it would be remiss not to talk about Mr. Tony Blair, who has stepped back from his role as envoy of the so-called quartet after 8 years. And you know, it's easy to mock because he's been described as the Middle East peace envoy for the past 8 years. And obviously, there's not been much peace. But actually, his issue was over economics, and it was about trying to help Palestinians in the West Bank and in Gaza improve the economy, technically, was what he was supposed to be doing. It's hard to see what he's done on that, other than obviously he's made himself a lot of money in the Middle East, but he hasn't really helped other people make much money.
I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think it's surprising that he's lasted that long in the position, 8 years, given his kind of many, many other interests and many other involvements. You know, obviously, he wasn't spending much time there. He had no credibility amongst the Palestinians. So the fact that he was even appointed to this seems ridiculous from the start. And, you know, the fact that he had business deals going on with some Arab countries as well and many private interests, I mean, for me,
And also Arab countries that also had bad relationships with the Palestinians as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. So it's unfathomable for me that he even had the position. And of course, that now in EU circles, at least, and also increasingly in Washington, I think he's seen as a bit of a dead weight, and, you know, he needs to go.
It's interesting, Tim, because in a sense, this is a bit of a non-story because he's not involved in it at all. But it's almost like it's the fact, yeah, because it was on the front of the FT today, it's been followed up everywhere. It's almost like this is the moment where, you know, we'll look back on this is the moment where he became an unserious character he's not a statesman anymore, an elder statesman who can be turned to.
I think he's going to be a businessman, and he will keep on going advising some fairly unsavory governments around the world on how they should conduct their affairs. I agree with Nina. I'm not sure it should ever have been appointed. And this is not I'm not against Mr. Blair, and I don't have any axe to grind with him, but I just thought at the time when he was appointed, everyone went, what? And then the Palestinians, they gave him a little bit of time, and then they just gave up on him after a few months. The Israelis just said, oh, he's that bloke who doesn't give us a hard time. Over the past year, your EU diplomats have been briefing against him, and this has been coming some time. And a few months ago, when the American diplomats started saying, you know what, nothing's really happening, it was clear he's on his way out. It should never have happened. It wasn't his fault that he hasn't got peace in the Middle East.
It's interesting that this weekend, Nina, he was, where was he? He was in Egypt praising El-Sisi.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, and that just, you know, that shows, like, I really don't think he's the right man for the job.
There we are, and he doesn't have it anymore. Nina Schick and Tim Marshall, thank you both very much indeed. That's all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. The programme was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Mike Hewin. The studio manager was Antonio Fernandez. For the next half hour, a Marcus Hippie will be here with Monocle's International Playlist. Then it's Culture with Rob Bound. We're back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours here in London, 1400 hours in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.